Interview with Philip D. Parker, February 25th, 2008, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
We're talking about background, so if we can go into that a little bit. Where did you go to law school?
UVA.
UVA? And did you have any inkling that you might be involved in securities when you did that?
No, I really didn't. My securities law professor was Ernie Falk, who was, you know, at the time known as Mr. Delaware Corporation Law, and a very gentlemanly Southern type. But he kind of got me interested in it. And then sitting on the bench in D.C. at the time was Judge Ritchie. And he grew up in Delaware, Ohio. My father was a doctor. He used to pay a house call on his mother, like, you know, once a week, because he lived right around the corner. So once when I was in Washington, I just stopped in to see him to chat, say hello. And I forget the relationship, but he was a very good friend to Stanley Sporkins. Mm. And he's, like, literally when I was sitting in his office, he said, "Stanley, I have somebody here you should talk to." And so I, walked from the courthouse over to the SEC and spoke to Stanley.
Wow.
And, he offered me a job.
And you were still in law school at this time? Or?
Yeah.
So what was it like meeting Stanley Sporkins? Did you know him by reputation at that point?
Not really. He's not someone who stood on ceremony.
Yeah.
He kind of cut to the chase immediately. And I remember I had a transcript, and he said, "There are no C's here. You must not be a gentleman." And that was the only, other than that, it was all business.
Yeah. Well, what was the business? I mean, did he tell you about what he was doing with enforcement and what he wanted young lawyers to come in and do?
I think it was more just, you come here, you'll get experience from day one, and practice, be sitting across the table from the best lawyers in the country, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Which, most government agencies make that pitch. It happens to be true in enforcement. There is very, very little startup time.
You must have had a little bit because you had to finish law school, though.
Yeah, but this was like in the spring of law school.
Okay. So tell me about your breaking in period. What was it like starting out in enforcement? What did you work on? Did they throw you right in and see if you could swim? Or?
Yeah, I think the first cases I worked on, I worked with more experienced attorneys. But by more experienced, I mean they were 2 years out of law school.
Mm-hmm.
And the cases ranged from, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act had not yet been enacted, but we were back in the days of questionable payments.
Right.
That, and I remember there was one kind of a, management perks case, self-dealing type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, kind of ran the gamut. I remember working on an accounting case, and I had never taken an accounting course in my life. I knew debits were on one side and credits were on the other, but they were supposed to balance at the end of the day, but that was it.
Yeah. Who were some of the people that you worked with, some of those senior folks in enforcement at that point?
Well, Ed Hurley, he was my first branch chief, and Ted Levine was the assistant. They reported to Erwin Borowski and then to Stanley. And that was for about at least 2 years, and then at some point there was kind of a reorganization because Ted became an associate, and Ed Hurley, he became an assistant, and so they moved over, and I had Rick Sharp, I think, was my next branch chief.
Well, this must have been a pretty exciting period, because this is the moment in the sun for the Division of Enforcement, mid to late 70s.
Well, the questionable payments thing got a lot of publicity.
Right.
There was Stanley taking on corporate America.
Right.
And yet, in terms, mean, what I remember is they had the voluntary payments program, or voluntary disclosure program, where if you agreed to do an internal investigation and, you know, restated if necessary, and do et cetera, you make full disclosure, that the agency wouldn't come after you, and so it was volunteer. But I remember that anyone who did that had an attorney assigned to go in and do due diligence, you know, kick the tires, make sure they did a real investigation. Because I can remember I got Merrill Lynch. And I just remember being on, you know, like the 73rd floor of their building down in Wall Street. And I was like 6 months on the staff. And, you know, up in like right off the chairman's office, you know, in this conference room. And I also remember that the amount of payments they came up with was ridiculously small. It was like, you know, $40,000 for worldwide Merrill Lynch. But, it was an interesting experience.
Did that, you handled that one all on your own?
Yeah, but I didn't, you know, it was just a question of going up and reviewing what they did.
Looking over somebody's shoulder, so to speak.
Right, you know, seeing, you know, reading the interview notes and that kind of thing to make sure. And, you know, because, you know, they really hadn't found that much. It wasn't, you know, this was something that was done in 2 days, probably.
Right.
You know, and Merrill Lynch back in 1976 didn't have offices, you know, around the globe like they do today. Or if they did, they were small, you know.
Right. And at this point, this wasn't a Lockheed case with the questionable payments.
No.
They were the poster child.
Right.
What were you learning? I mean, as you come in and you're in your six-month, year period, and I would imagine you're soaking things up pretty quickly. What were the folks in enforcement imparting to you as a young lawyer?
I mean, the obvious, learning how to take testimony and learning what to look for. And I think what you learn doing investigations is how corporate entities work. You know, it's a really funny feeling that you don't get anywhere except in a position like the SEC. I mean, I'd go in and take testimony sometimes, and, you know, of course, I had read everything the witness had produced. You know, this was before the days of emails, but all the internal memos, et cetera, et cetera. If it's an accounting case, I've read, you know, the accountant's work papers, so I have all their internal memos. A lot of times, you know, there are big loan files from their corporate lenders, from their banks, contra parties on big transactions, and you go in there and you think, you know, I'm the only person on the planet who's read all of these, you know. He knows what's in his files, and he may have an inkling as into what theirs files, but nobody knows everything, and it's a tremendous advantage, and you get a lot of insights, you know, just being able to look at it from different perspectives. You know, how the memo may say X, but they're really saying Y when they meet.
And, right.
And it's especially true in accounting cases, you know, the calculus that goes back and forth with, you know, the company and the accountants.
And so you're seeing the give and take that leads to whatever decision.
Well, you know, and they understand they can't lie to their accountants, but they talk themselves into thinking, if they don't ask, I don't need to tell, you know.
Right. So I guess you saw this over a number of different corporations then, and you start to get a sense of similarities?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's just a way of learning how to assess things in a, you know, slightly more sophisticated way, you know, not to react to the literal words that are in the paper, but to look at the context and the motivation and everything else that plays into it.
And how long were you in enforcement before you got your first promotion?
Well, you know, you go from GS 11 to 12 to 13, and that's almost, I mean, it's not automatic, but a great percentage of them do.
Mm-hmm.
I became a branch chief after about 3.5 years or so.
How do your duties change at that point?
You're kind of responsible for the care and feeding of a lot of different people. You know, not a lot, but, you know, whoever's in your branch, mm-hmm. 5 or 6. Although, typically, you're still actively, at least we were then, you know, we'd be actively investigating as well. You know, it's like if you have somebody who's relatively new and there's testimony, it may be the branch chief and that person in doing it together.
Right, so you're training people, things like that. Right.
But training by example, not by having, you know, little classrooms and
right.
tutorials.
Right.
And by, you know, by working together.
So you talked about some of the big cases, and I see they're laid out here. William F. Buckley is a very interesting one, and I think that must have happened fairly early on in your career.
Yeah, I was a third or fourth year attorney, and I can't recall how it started, but, you know, it was a very interesting cast of characters, and it was the kind of case that a newspaper reporter dreams about, because there were just a lot of things about the case that were just funny. You know? I mean, it was in a sense tragic, because the CEO of this company was William Buckley's former newspaper boy, delivered his newspaper. And this guy started a company that was, you know, not real large, but they owned about a dozen radio and TV stations. And, you know, part of the humor in the case were, like, some of the TV stations were black, you know, all black soul formats, which is not what people associated with Buckley. Those happened to be their most profitable stations. But aside from that, the Starr brothers, Peter Starr was the former newspaper boy, they had a private partnership in which Buckley was a participant, and they were investing in drive-in movie theaters. And the business theory was that the theaters would throw off enough revenue to cover the carrying cost. And meanwhile, these drive-in theaters that were located in the exurbs of major cities would, you know, the land would appreciate, and they'd sell the land and make a fortune. And they got caught, I think, by the, you know, back in the late 70s, the prime rate went from 5 to something absurd,
right,
like 18 or something.
Yeah.
So they just had enormous debt service, which they couldn't meet. And at some point, you know, you can almost see it happen. You know, just as I talk, you can see what's going to happen. Citgo, the private partnership, sold all the assets and liabilities to the public company. And that's what the case was about.
Okay.
It was the disclosure related to that. You know, they ended up unwinding, and Buckley paid, you know, he paid back a little over $1 million, which was really the debt that was taken over.
And this was money that went to the shareholders then of the company that
went back to the corporation, and yeah, wasn't necessarily distributed to shareholders,
right,
but it was, you know, they basically rescinded the deal between the partnership and the company.
So was this the kind of thing that you would get routinely? It just happened to have a famous name attached to it, this particular case?
No, it just, you know, It could have been John Smith. It happened to be William Buckley.
Right. Any other notable cases from those early years?
In the early 80s, I had a case that was an insider trading case that you could have written a daily log about what was happening in the investigation. It was so, you know, A, funny, and B, dramatic. I mean, what happened is we had a group of people in New York. The named guy was Dominic Musella. There was another guy named DeAngelis, But anyway, these people, as far as we could tell, had never traded securities in their life. And the day before a major takeover, they open up new accounts, buy out-of-the-money call options, and make some $100,000.
So their names came up pretty quick. Right?
Right. And we called them in to testify, and, you know, Masella wouldn't even say, "I refuse to testify on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment." He'd just hold up his hand and say, "Take five." And then he said, "You guys can go out and have a lunch. You know, you have the whole afternoon, now you can have lunch." I mean, it was almost, you know, smirking at us.
Huh.
Well, anyway, they went on and traded in like four or five more deals. And always, you know, out of the money, you know, at the last second and so forth. And the network of purchasers kept getting larger. It ended up being eight or nine. And some of the new ones were buying, you know, much smaller amounts, but at the same time. Mm-hmm. Well, we tried to see what these deals had in common, and the first five deals had Merrill Lynch as investment banker for either the bidder or the target or, you know, something. And they were literally turning their place upside down, you know, trying to figure out where the leak was from. Mm-hmm. And they were acting as if they were entirely convinced that the leak was somewhere in Merrill Lynch, as were we. It was the only common link that we saw. And then another deal comes by. These guys buy it. Merrill's nowhere in the horizon. And they're celebrating. They, like, break out the champagne, you know. And we couldn't find the link. And then we had a big graph, you know, of all the firms, and Sullivan and Cromwell was in all but one. And then somehow, I forget what happened, somehow we found out that they were in the deal, you know, like it was like the third or fourth in the chain. They were in it behind the scenes. It was like, you know, a potential white knight, or, you know, it was something like
that. And that one missing deal.
But they did have something. And then at some point in the chain, and then eventually it was like 9 or 10 transactions these guys bought, but at some point in the chain, they bought the wrong stock. They bought the bidder rather than the target. So that's when we think, you know, these aren't the, you know, brightest crayons in the box, you know. So we tried to figure it out, and as it turned out, the tipper in the case worked at Sullivan and Cromwell, and he was the head of courier services. So, like, if they were sending a confidential memo across town, you know, apparently he was just looking in the envelope first and then dispatching it off. Well, in the deal where they bought the wrong stock, I mean, I can't remember the details, but it was something like, you know, they created a corporation for the purpose of the transaction, and, you know, if you're buying Acme, you know, it was called Acme Inc. or, you know, Acme Com or something. Mm-hmm. It was some derivation, and I think they even had a draft lawsuit that was never filed to stop it. But you could see how somebody who didn't know what they were looking at would get the impression that it's A buying B rather than B buying A.
Yeah,
you know, so that.
So you knew this wasn't somebody up in a corner office in the top floors.
Well, and they weren't the kind of tippies that person would have either.
Yeah. That's for sure. So how'd you catch the guy?
Good question. I mean, I remember we filed the case, and, you know, we filed it without you know, any consents or anything. I know the lead guy, Masella, I think right after we sued, or was run over by a car. It was in a car accident, hit by a car, so he had deceased. And I'm trying to think of how, eventually I think somebody cooperated with us in the litigation. What I remember about the filing is that we never referred to Sullivan and Cromwell because, you know, we really didn't think it was fair, you know. So it said it was upon information misappropriated from a major New York law firm or something like that. And, you know, the case is filed one day at 9 o'clock, and at 9:15, a reporter's in, why didn't you just name Sullivan and Cromwell? I mean, it didn't take them long to figure out.
Hmm. But you figured since it was just a courier, it didn't rise to the level of involving the firm itself.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember exactly what I think it was, but I think it was just, you know, it wasn't... We didn't want, or didn't think it was good for the newspaper reports to be playing that angle up. And it turned out some of the remote tippies of Marcel and DeAngelis, there were like three members who were New York City policemen who bought them. So that of course, got a lot of publicity.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your involvement with Gulf and Western, which I guess was Charles Blue Dorn.
I still, if I'm in Manhattan and see the MetLife building, I still think of it as the Gulf and Western building.
Yeah.
I actually did not. That investigation went on for a very long time, you know, at least 3 or 4 years. I was involved really only in one aspect of it towards the end, which was kind of interesting in terms of the international aspect of it. We used to joke that the Dominican Republic was virtually a wholly owned subsidiary of Gulf and Western because they had these huge sugar plantations. And Blue Dorn, I'm trying to remember exactly how it worked. Blue Dorn and the Prime Minister or the President or whatever it is of the Dominican Republic was a guy named Balaguer, Joaquin Balaguer. They were hedging against the production of their crop. You know, they were buying it. You know, Blue Dorn started off as a commodities trader, so this is what he really loved to do. They were hedging, and at some point, and they were splitting the profits, like 60-40 or something from their trades. And at some point, they get into a terrible disagreement over, you know, the future direction of prices. You know, Blue Dorn was convinced it was going to go up and Balaguer down or vice versa. So anyway, Blue Dorn was the one actually executing these trades. He started trading the way he thought they should trade, but basically telling Balaguer he was trading the way Balaguer wanted to trade. So it was like two sets of books. And that was... And it translated into a fair amount of money, but that was part of the case. It was like this. It was almost like a contingent liability owed to the Dominican Republic, or if Balaguer found out what, you know, what he would have done to Gulf and Western. I mean, it's not. It's a rather bizarre allegation for the
right.
for the SEC to make. But that, you know, that was that aspect of the case.
Yeah, and that was a much more complicated case, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean the case had several, you know, a lot of moving parts that were unrelated to each other. I mean, Gulf and Western was a, you know, one of the first conglomerates of totally disparate companies, and you know, they have, you know, motion pictures, car bumpers. I mean, right. I'm trying to think of what else was in there, and you know, you put it all together.
I read an account.
I always remember when Blue Dorn died. He died on the corporate jet on a Saturday of a heart attack. And the stock closed at something like $7 a share on Friday, and on Monday it closed at something like $12. And I always thought if Blue Dorn knew he was going to die and he told everyone he knew to short the stock, and instead it almost doubled because the market's reaction was that the company was worth more than, you know, that with new leadership it was going to recoup more of its value.
Well, apparently it was, because Paramount did really well after after he was gone. Well, at this, I think that was toward the end of Stanley Sporkin's time in enforcement.
The Masella case was actually in John Fetter's era.
Okay. How did the division change as you went from the Sporkin era to the John Fetter's era?
Oh, I think, you know, it stayed the same more than it changed. I always remember John's catchphrase when he started was procedural tightness. You know, he wanted He wanted more regularity in the processes and having, you know, the different units acting in the same way and, you know, more in an organized, programmatic way rather than personal. Stanley tended to let people adapt to their own style, you know. Which, you know, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. It's just, you know, he was less focused on that kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm not sure things changed that much under Fetters. There was, you know, maybe a little bit more review at the end of cases. But we're talking percentages here, not a sea change.
Mm-hmm. Because I know one of the things that John Chatt, you know, wanted to do was get the SEC back to where enforcement wasn't the big show.
Well, Chatt also, you know, kind of set up the unit in the general counsel's office and gave them a mandate to, you know, he supposedly said, I want you to find something wrong with every enforcement recommendation that goes to the commission. I don't think he literally meant kill every enforcement case. He just said, if there's an issue, I want it teed up. I want to know about it. And so I think commission meetings became, you know, longer than they were before, and there was more discussion of the issues. But it's really much more, you know, a function of the commission than it is. I mean, when I started, you know, you had Phil Loomis and Irv Pollack on the commission. You know, you remember Loomis saying stuff like, you know, that's not what 10b-6 means, and I know because I wrote it. I mean, he literally knew the history of everything that was in front of him. Mm-hmm. And Irv had been, you know, enforcement director for so long. You know, they didn't need someone in general counsel's office to brief them on potential issues. I mean, you know, they had it right at their fingertips. That really, you know, throughout the 80s, you had very good commissioners, but you didn't have people with that kind of experience, and so there was something, you know, it was useful to have, you know, people teeing up issues that might otherwise be missed. Yeah, and Chatt himself was not a lawyer.
Right.
He came from an investment banking background, and I think at least initially was a little bit insecure about, you know, the legal niceties and phrases people were throwing around. But, you know, I think, you know, he got up to speed pretty quickly.
Well,
He was a very conservative guy in certain ways. He didn't like to make mistakes.
You know. Not willing to fly by the seat of his pants or
right.
anything like that.
And, yeah. That's well, like in insider trading cases, that really comes across because they're either guilty or they're not. You know, it's not like in accounting cases, you know, well, there's a violation, but how bad is it? Or, you know, but, you know, you get some insider trading cases that look suicidal. You know, you have a senior corporate executive or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Those were the kind of cases where you'd be, are you sure? You know, he'd really want to get comfortable.
So you would take these things to Chatt and say, This is the set of circumstances we're looking at. At can we proceed or not?
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't. You know, I mean, it wasn't a question of killing cases that deserved to be brought. It was just like he wanted to be personally comfortable before he pushed the button and said file the case. And it worked both ways, though, because I can remember back when Giuliani was U.S. attorney. Was arresting people at Goldman Sachs and marching them out of their office, and these were people that the SEC hadn't sued civilly. Mm-hmm. You know, Chatt was wondering, well, why don't we? You know, why aren't we bringing a case against these people? What's Giuliani know that we don't know? And it was really more a question of what the lawyers in enforcement believed was the law versus what Giuliani believed was the law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because some of these people were never prosecuted.
He'd just pick them up and see what he could do with them, and the SEC didn't operate that way?
Well, I mean, the cases I remember, you know, you had a string of people back then. Mm-hmm. Boesky and then Marty Siegel and like that. And so you get a, you know, Marty Siegel, you get a cooperating witness who's telling you everything he knows because he wants to reduce his sentence as much as possible. And a lot of, you know, sometimes he's telling you stuff that doesn't sound right, it doesn't look kosher, but when you really think it through, it's probably not a violation of the law. You know, I mean, it gets to the point where you get these deals with white knights and third parties and all this stuff going back and forth. Sometimes it gets confusing. It's hard to, you have to distinguish between, you know, what's a situation where somebody's breaching a duty and, you know, giving you information that that's inappropriate, or, you know, who's telling you something that they have a right to tell you. I mean, you know, I mean, if I'm, if I'm a third party and I decide I might make a bid for somebody and it's in my interest to tell you I'm thinking of doing that, I'm probably, you know, that's probably okay, you know.
So there's a lot of gray area in there that, that you're thinking about all the time. Did you, well, John Shadd wasn't, there, he didn't let a lot of gray area stand between him and the fact that he was going to prosecute insider trading. That was the thing that he was going to do.
Bobtail boots.
Yeah. Now, did you see a great increase in insider trading cases because of that?
I think they were always around 10% of the total. I mean, they may have gone up, but they tended to get more publicity because it's easier for reporters to grasp them. And so you had the feeling there were more, but I'm not sure statistically it was an increase of that much. And offsetting, you know, Shad's intent were, we kept getting hit over the head by the Supreme Court. You know, with the Dirks case and the Fiorella case and Chessman. So it was always like, you know, you have to go back to the drawing board and rethink. And after, I guess after Dirks, I mean, I can remember a couple of cases I worked on that we chose not to bring. And I truly believe if, you know, if I, if an enforcement attorney today had the same case and, you know, and was told we're not going to bring the case, would, you know, probably be sending memos to Capitol Hill or something, you know, that, you know, just the facts really look pretty compelling, you know, just the circumstantial evidence. But, you know, this was, we had lost twice in a row in the Supreme Court. It just wasn't in our interest to make bad law. And yeah, I mean, and I'm not, I don't mean to imply that there were a lot of these. I just happened to have one where we spent a lot of time, and then ultimately decided not to bring the case.
And at that point, the argument was fiduciary responsibility or something like that. I mean, there were all these, the things that the Supreme Court was hitting at were basically the rationale for insider trading, or how do you define insider trading?
Yeah, and you know, it's. It's not only you have to breach a duty, you have to show that the person intended to obtain a benefit. Well, that's something we just took for granted. You know, we never really thought about it at all. You know, then all of a sudden you have to start analyzing it in different ways and become prepared to prove it in different ways. And, you know, a lot of time has passed now, and we won the O'Hagan case, but I used to joke that insider trading was a body of law consisting largely of cases the SEC lost. And, you know, people, and now it's 20 years later and people forget that, you know. They think, you know, you're always going to win an insider trading case, but our record in litigated cases, you know, wasn't anywhere close to 100%.
Yeah, certainly not at that point.
Yeah, we had to remember that. You wouldn't remember, but there was a case against Barry Switzer, who was the football coach at the University of Oklahoma. And Switzer's testimony was that he was at his son's high school football game, and it was a nice day, and he decided to sunbathe, so he was lying on his back on the top bleacher, And in the row in front of him was the president of this company and his wife, and he happened to overhear the president of the company telling his wife they were going to, you know, whatever the inside information was.
Right.
Well, you know, a jury of his peers accepted that as true and acquitted him.
Yeah.
You know.
And not insider trading.
Well, they chose to believe his testimony that he was an innocent bystander who happened to overhear it.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I recall, the wife said her husband never spoke business with her. I mean, people thought, you know, that's a preposterous alibi.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was, went to trial and he won.
So that was another one of those things that would come through your mind when you'd think about whether to take an insider trading case or not. Things like that. Well, you said that that was consistently 10% of what you were doing, more or less. What about the other 90%? Did that change with the times, or was that also fairly consistent?
Well, I mean, yeah, in the 80s, the contested takeovers became a big deal. Yeah, just the M&A activity was much greater, and there was, you know, more going on in that arena.
How would that end up in enforcement?
What I remember is you'd have a contested takeover, and both parties would come into enforcement, you know, requesting meetings and screaming about the outrageous fraud being perpetrated by the other side, and going back and forth for 3 or 4 weeks, and then all of a sudden they'd cut some sweetheart deal and neither side wanted to talk to you anymore. You know, they'd just kiss and make up. You know, yeah, effectively they were using enforcement to gain leverage.
Huh. Was Gary Lynch the head of enforcement by that time?
He started 84, I think.
And
so he was the director throughout the, you know, the Boesky, Levine,
right.
Siegel, you know, that whole trifecta
right.
cases.
Did he, again, sort of the same question, did he bring a change of culture or a change of focus to the Division of Enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gary had superb judgment. Those cases I was describing before were, you know, Giuliani's indicting people and Shad's wondering why we're not bringing civil cases. Theirs were in Gary's watch, and he's the one who would have to go through step by step with Chairman Shad and explain what we were doing, what we were not doing, and why. And this was a time, too, where the international enforcement, especially in insider trading cases, was becoming more pivotal. That's when the Santa Fe and St. Joe cases were what's obviously insider trading. Dennis Levine was trading through a Swiss bank, and you know, the trading was totally irrational unless he had inside information. They were buying deep out of the money options just before the announcement. So that really kind of started that whole road of negotiating an MOU with Switzerland to Pierce Brink secrecy, and that just kind of grew upon itself. And Gary did a lot of that, although Michael Mann, day-to-day, was the person negotiating. Negotiating and also coming up with, you know, creative ways to approach foreign regulatory authorities and convince them that it was in their interest to help us, which he was very good at doing.
Did you yourself have any involvement with any of the foreign enforcement cases?
Not really. I mean, when they first set up the, I forget what it was called, Office of International Legal Assistance and Enforcement, I was chief counsel then, and I think on paper Michael reported to me because they had to have some box for him, but he was, in reality, he was just kind of freestanding, reporting to Gary Lynch. I mean, I would be involved tangentially, but I never really worked on one of the ones where we really had to pierce foreign secrecy.
Right. So as chief counsel, would you just sort of be in this office on the side and looking at sort of the broader picture, making sure things were kosher as far as the legalities are concerned?
Yeah, and you had oversight, in a sense, of the regional office enforcement. Regional office enforcement recommendations would go through the chief counsel's office. In part, just to make sure everyone was on the same page, that Miami office wasn't advocating a theory that contradicted what the Seattle office was. And in part, a lot of times these things were at the commission and they weren't even in Washington. We were presenting the case on their behalf.
Right.
It also focused on programmatic issues, legislative issues, if they're whatever John Dingell was upset about, would be your problem and went away. And there was a lot of that done.
Yeah. What kinds of things was he upset about?
He dabbled a lot in the insider trading stuff. He was very interested in the accounting cases. I guess it's pretty hard to think of anything he was not interested in.
And he let you know about it if you wanted to see something happen.
Well, he'd send what we called dinglegrams. And these would be letters, please answer the following 23 questions. And it would be an enormous amount of work, compiling all this stuff and putting a happy face on it and so forth.
So you were coordinating the regional enforcement offices in the 1980s, is that right?
For a couple of years, like 84 or 85, 6, 7.
Did you see, did those regional offices have very different priorities because of where they were and what the business was in that area?
Well, there was a little bit of that. The Denver office would have more cases involving mining companies, New York would have more, cases coming from the street, broker dealers, but they were all doing a little bit of everything.
Was that a new system, having them report through this general counsel's office?
No, there had always been a group in enforcement that did it. It's that Fetters created the chief counsel's office.
Okay.
And that was part of his, I just wanted to have a more programmatic focus.
Okay, so your job was to ensure the programmatic focus, so to speak.
A little bit, although the office, by the time I became chief counsel, it had been around 3 or 4 years, and Fetters was gone. Fetters made me chief counsel, so he was still there.
Okay.
I was trying to remember the timing of when he left.
Well, somewhere in here you had the Paul Thayer case, which is another one of those cases that the reporters enjoyed.
Yeah, I was a branch chief on that. Yeah, that was a case that you got to believe was vetted pretty closely by John Chet.
Yeah.
But by the time we bought it, there wasn't the slightest bit of doubt in our mind, because these people had purchased, related back to the time when Thayer was chairman of LTV, prior to becoming Kapner's Deputy Secretary of Defense. And there had been two acquisitions made by LTV, and these people bought in front of both. And then at some point, but he, steadfastly denied to have been anybody. At some point towards the end of the investigation, we found that there had been a third deal which preceded these two, and I can't remember the particulars. It may have been a deal they were going to make but backed off at the last instance. But we found these people had bought that stock too. So it was like, you know, lightning doesn't strike three times. And there, you know, there were substantial things. But that, you know, that had a cast of characters that if you put it in a novel, it would be panned for unrealism. Because the principal tippy was a stockbroker who people said was known by more people in Dallas than Thayer himself was. He was a close friend of Don Meredith, you know, from Monday Night Football fame. And one of his tippies was Johnny Mathis, or Billy Mathis, who was the fullback on Namath's Super Bowl team. You know, it's like, I forget who some of the others were, but it's like, you know, what did these people have in common? And they all, you know, all went back to Thayer. But he actually was indicted, and not for the insider trading, but for false statements in the testimony before the SEC.
One other one that your name was involved in, which is really interesting, had to do with a stockbroker being a CIA front or something like that. It was Rewald. This is out of a New York Times article. Something having to do with the CIA had, this guy had been acting for the CIA supposedly, and meanwhile his business had gone bust and all his investors were stuck. Would have been in the early 80s.
I'm having a senior moment.
That's okay. It's just kind of an interesting story in that they were running around. I think Dingell was running around saying, okay, you know, what other CIA fronts are out there dealing securities?
Well, yeah, and Dingell was where he was when Bill Casey was chairman of the CIA, or chairman of the SEC, and Casey in the early 80s was at the CIA, and Stanley Sporkin was over with him, so I can see Dingell making the connection in his mind pretty quickly.
Did you have any? One of the things that going into the 90s, sort of moving through enforcement, moving through the insider trading cases, I noticed there was some new involvement in municipal bonds. This must have been an Arthur Levitt kind of a thing. Did you have any involvement in that?
Well, I can remember. I can remember spending a lot of time reading the Whoops report, the Washington Public Power thing. And I think that was just a case of Gary Lynch coming in one day with his 8-inch thick binder and says, I can't deal with this. Read this. Because, yeah, I remember. It was just, the report was like 500 pages, and you know, we're trying to edit it down to something more manageable, and that just took a long time to do. And I kind of think we ended up doing like a 50-page executive summary and attaching the report as an exhibit for those people who really wanted to become immersed in the details. But actually, by the time, you know, when I was in the general counsel's office when Arthur came in, and you know, I worked, you know, a little bit on the municipal bond rulemaking, but I really wasn't responsible for any of it. And but I remember going on, and, you know, and I think it was a good thing. I think it was a part of the securities world that probably hadn't been looked at closely enough before that time. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the move from enforcement to the general counsel's office is, it seems unusual anyway. I don't know if that was, it was a common thing. But why did you make that move?
I mean, I just think what I was doing in the chief counsel's office was, in a sense, more similar to what I was doing in general, what I did in the general counsel's office than to what I was doing before that, because I was not, you know, actively investigating cases. I basically enjoy reading and writing, and thought, you know, if I hadn't gone to the SEC, I probably would have gone into academics. You know, and I just enjoyed doing it.
So you're really working with the law and working with the cases in that way?
Yeah, more so. Although, you know, I mean, the general counsel's office job was fun because, in a sense, you're responsible for everything and nothing at the same time. You know, so right. you're always working on, you know, what's topical, what's current. That day, I eventually got quite tired of congressional hearings and legislative stuff, but you know, that was after several years, and we did a lot of legislation in that period.
How did you get involved in that?
I just, you know, there had always been an Office of Legislative Affairs, but it was, you know, just one or two people. Mm-hmm. I think historically, the general counsel's office would typically work on legislative matters with the division that was most interested. I mean, you know, if it was, whether it was Market Reg or Corp Fin or something, but and we tended to handle a lot of the oversight stuff just for, you know, somebody's got to do it. And it was easier to have a kind of a dedicated group of people.
Well, getting to the legislation, I mean, was there more legislative activity in the going into the 1990s in Arthur Levitt's time, and why would that have been?
Well, I mean, you had, just before I got to the SEC, you had the Securities Act amendments of 75. That probably was the biggest piece of legislation since 1940, you know, in the Advisors Act and the Company Act. In 77, you had the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which was really kind of a focus thing. But it was really a lot of the legislation in the 80s and 90s, late 80s and 90s, was enforcement at ITSBIA, which was what, insider trading. There was ITSA, then ITSBIA, both dealing with insider trading, like 84 and 88, I think. And then the Enforcement Remedies Act was in 1992. And that was when Richard Breeden was in his first year as chairman. He thought it was preposterous that the agency didn't have the authority to impose civil fines or seek fines, you know, and that we really needed to beef up our enforcement remedies. So that was in 92, and then in 96 was the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act.
Right.
Which was, you know, that was driven by the Hill, not by the SEC.
Part of Newt Gingrich's contract with America, all that Republican renaissance?
I think so, although I'm kind of thinking at least parts of it had started before that, but that certainly gave it the momentum. Because I think it was mostly House-driven as opposed to Senate.
Okay. And is this when you spent all your time on the Hill during this process for the that piece of legislation?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about
more
it.
More than I, you know.
Yeah, tell me a little about the process, how it's done. Did you work with the commission? Did you work with Arthur Levitt?
Well, it depended on the legislation, but like enforcement remedies, you know, as I recall, we, you know, we worked with enforcement, you know, we kind of came to a consensus at the staff level as to what made sense, you know, what we should ask for, you know, and then worked it out with the commission. And when we do that, you know, we actually draft the language, we draft the, you know, all the background pieces, you know, like why this is needed, why it makes sense, et cetera, et cetera.
And then you take that up to the Hill?
Yeah. And I think that we, legislative affairs people, would have talked it through with people, and, you know, we'd know we had a sponsor when we went up there. Mm-hmm. And it would be like Markey from Massachusetts. He was a...
Ed Markey?
Yeah, he was a big sponsor for us when he ran the telecommunications and finance subcommittee of energy and commerce. He was under Dingell, or, you know, with Dingell. He was a big supporter of us. I remember Chris Cox was on that committee, I think, at the time. I know he worked on the Private Enforcement Litigation Act when
right.
he was a congressman.
Right. I think he introduced that.
Did
or something it? Like that, yeah. You said you spent a lot of time on the Hill. What's a lot of time?
Oh, I mean, in those years, I was probably spending 30% of my time on,
wow.
not on the Hill, but on Hill-related type things. And I haven't been back, you know. Watching Roger Clemens up there 2 weeks ago, I said, that's why I don't want to be
yeah.
there anymore.
So you would actually appear before the Congress and the congressmen and say, you know, explain why this you need this stuff.
Well, I mean, I would be meeting with their staff people in some conference room
okay.
at a hearing, you know, it would be Arthur Levitt or Richard Breed.
Okay.
But, you know, there's just so much posturing that goes on at those hearings that you have to prepare for all these when did you stop shooting your wife questions,
right.
and, you know. It just goes on and on. And for the Litigation Reform Act, you know, of course, you had the all the interested constituencies who wanted to weigh in on everything.
What was your perspective from the general counsel's office and certainly on the commission itself? I mean, depending on who you ask, the Litigation Reform Act was, you know, a terrible reversal, a step backwards, and of course somebody like Chris Cox would argue no. What was the sense inside the SEC at this point?
Well, people felt strongly both ways. I did not want to see them cut back too much, but certain parts of it, I think, were good things. I mean, the whole notion back then that whoever filed first would become lead plaintiff was just an absurd result.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always thought it was a good idea to have, you know, a process whereby, you know, the plaintiffs with the constituencies at the most at stake would decide who the plaintiff's attorneys were going to be and would actually run the case. And so it did get pension funds and things of that type involved in the process, which I think was good. And to me, that was the most pivotal thing. A lot of it was just many parts of the bill I just thought were like legislative micromanagement, you know, and, you know, things about pleading standards and everything like that. And I don't think it's done tremendous harm. I'm not sure it's done that much good either.
Would you work with the divisions to help frame the language that you would contribute to this?
Yeah, it was mostly enforcement.
Okay.
And, you know, and we'd work with, you know, there was a fair amount of, you know, it was obvious that this was going to, some type of bill was going to pass. And, you know, just the whole gestalt was working in that direction.
Right.
So, you know, there were some, you know, we were playing defense some of the time. We wanted to make what was inevitable happen in a way that caused the least harm.
Well, we've moved right through your career at the SEC. Is there anything that we've missed? Anything having to do particularly with your relations with international affairs?
Well, you know, the international thing kind of grew, you know, agency-wide. You know, so it got to the point where it was hard not to be involved in international stuff. You know, by the late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of wool making. You know, Reg S, Wool 144A, Market Reg was doing market links, and 15A6 was passed at that time. So, like, you know, internally within the commission, a lot of the most important wool making was in the international area. So, you know, everybody was focused on it. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was much more technical assistance work going on in Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, places like that. And I know at some point we got a $3 million grant from AID for technical assistance in Eastern Europe.
Did you ever take part in any of those efforts?
I went on one trip to the Czech Republic. Well, actually, I went to Czechoslovakia, and I was in Bratislava on the day it became independent. You know, so I went to Czechoslovakia, came back from the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and that, you know, that was like a 10-day or a week-long thing. It was very interesting because they, at the time in the Czech Republic, they were trying to decide, you know, they were developing a market and they were torn somewhat between having a NASDAQ-type computer-to-computer market or to have, you know, the old-fashioned New York Stock Exchange with real people. And I just kind of remember talking to people and they'd kind of try to see which side you were on and react appropriately. And the subplot was that a lot of the most sophisticated people, most computer literate, either were or were suspected of being former KGB types. So, you know, that pushed people to the other side of the pendulum in some cases. I did that. Then I also went, I think at the request of the State Department, the European Parliament, not the EU, the European Parliament, which some people don't even realize still exists, they were meeting in Strasbourg, in Alsace-Lorraine, and they wanted to have a European-wide definition of insider trading. So I went over there on two occasions for about a week each time, where we spent, you know, 4 or 5 days debating piece by piece the ins and outs of insider trading. And it was very fascinating because they, you know, in a sense had little or no experience in insider trading. This was like 87, 88. Mm-hmm. And most countries didn't even have laws. And yet by the end of the process, they were doing pretty well. And, you know, in the United States, we still don't have a NASDAQ story definition of insider trading.
Right.
And, you know, they were doing at least as well as we were.
Well, the question would have been, why do you want one, right? Because I've heard it said that, you know, it's intentional that we don't have a definition here, because if you had one, then people would figure out how to get around.
But after the, I'm trying to think, it was after the, I think the Chessman case. Oh, I know, it was after, it was either after Shad left and before Reuter came, or after Reuter left and before Breeden. It's a weird way to say it, but I distinctly remember there was no chairman. And it must have been between Shad and Reuter, because it was Cox, Grunfest, Alana Peters. But But anyway, it was I think Dingell, it was either the center of the house, say, we demand that you come up with a definition of insider trading, and we demand that you have it to us within, you know, 14 days. And I can remember it was a weekend, and we spent about 4 hours on a Saturday with the commissioners, you know, kind of informal, but it was in the commission meeting room, going through word by, you know, line by line, and then working all weekend. And I can remember driving it around and dropping it off at their house or apartment on Sunday, and it was really a lot of fun. But what I remember about the process is we developed a list of like 15 questions, which were short hypotheticals, and you had to vote. You know, is this insider trading, not insider trading, or what? And that was the first thing we did, is we went through those 15 questions, and if there were differences, people had to explain why, but it, you know, it forced people to focus. And as I recall, we came out with a definition that everybody was happy with, and they were pretty far apart in some, you know, on some issues at the beginning. But you know, it wasn't like you came out with something where somebody read it, oh, now I see, that's what it is. I mean, it was about, you know, it was probably 8 or 9 parts, you know, subsection A, subsection B. You know, so
you did have a definition of insider trading.
I don't know whatever happened to it. We sent it to the Hill, and, you know, it's probably an election, different people in power, but we, I mean, we did in the sense that everybody left, at the end of the process, everybody was happy that it reached the result they would have wanted in, you know, all these hypotheticals. Mm-hmm. It's just extraordinarily hard to do if you're going to, you know, if you want it to make sense in all the different contexts that it makes sense, you know. You have trading in your own company stock, trading in someone else's, tender offers, mergers, and you had the separate crop. You know, after Dirks, it was, you know, what to do with analysts. You know, we don't want to sue analysts. What to do with newspaper reporters. Remember the Winans case in the Wall Street Journal? So I remember there were like separate provisions for, you know, reporters and analysts and so forth.
Insider trading's always been a pretty protean concept. Anything else?
I have cases now, you know, where I'm on the other side.
Yeah.
And I just want to say you can't possibly believe that's insider trading. Because you still have cases where they don't like the conduct. But when, you know, when you analyze it in terms of duty, you know, I always like to say that if I'm walking down the street and a truck turns the corner too fast and a prospectus comes flying out and lands at my feet and it's about a takeover going to happen the next day, I'm just lucky, you know. And they will say, but you knew it was material, non-public, you knew it. And I said, well, yeah, I did, but, you know, you can't make that illegal. once you start going down that road, you get the results that don't make sense. You know?
Did the SEC ever come close to doing that, in your experience?
Yeah, I think they do it all the time without without thinking about it. I mean, they say, you know, he knew it was non-public. He knew it was, you know, it was material.
Right.
He made it money. And you know, a lot of times it's true.
Would the thing flying out of the truck have been covered by that piece of paper that with the 9 points?
No.
So maybe we need to.
I mean, you know, there are people who lie in the top row of the bleachers and overhear things, you know. May not have been Switzer, but it does happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Or overheard at a party or something like that.
Yeah.
Anything else that we haven't touched on that we should talk about?
I think so.
So did the Litigation Reform Act just wear you out, and that's why you decided to retire from the SEC?
Yeah, a little bit of that. It was, but, you know, It's also my kids being 3 years away from college.
Yeah, that has a way of focusing one's mind as well. How has your time on the SEC affected the way, you know, the way that you work now and your approach toward your practice at this point? Other than the obvious in that you're sort of working the other side of the street.
Well, no, because I don't think of it in those terms. It's the only place I worked before here, so it's hard to compare. I do say, people always say, well, don't you feel funny? You're on the other side and like that. Don't you feel funny psychologically? And I've never really felt that way at all. It's just, there's always something. Always something to be done for your client that really deserves to be done.
Yeah.
And I find too, it's like how many people, you know, get into trouble or come close to getting in trouble without really meaning to. I always refer to what I call the lost sleep test. And I said, you know, did this person lose any sleep because of a guilty conscience, because they thought they were doing something wrong. And it's remarkable how often you really conclude they did not. Maybe they were insensitive, maybe they didn't pay attention to details, maybe they just don't focus, but there are a lot of people, you know, charged with fraud who, you know, never really worried that they were doing anything wrong. In accounting cases, you know, you get situations where people get deeply immersed in transactions. They want to make them happen. They want to regenerate the revenue, but they're totally indifferent to how it's accounted for. You know, it's not even in their radar screen. They say, that's why we have a chief financial officer, and that's why we have accountants. And, you know, if there's a problem, the accountants will tell us. And, you know, if that goes too far, you can be charged with, you know, say you're reckless. You know, you can't just be indifferent. You have a, you know,
but there's a lot of things going on, and it's easy for one person to lose track of them.
Yeah.
So you keep track of them for them. Well, thank you very much for talking to me. I appreciate
it. Okay.